I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Kenyon Fields and Mary Conover. Kenyon is a founding member of the Western Landowners Alliance. Mary is owner of the Mountain Island Ranch in Western Colorado and Utah. She's also a member of the Western Landowners Alliance. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
So this is a very interesting organization because it spans a lot of different ideas, people, interests. I mean, we're talking about ranchers who are doing conservation, landowners who are diversifying the way that they are managing their land. You, Kenyon, come from a conservation biology background, looking at big landscapes. How did you start this organization?
I was working all around the West with a number of conservation biologists and ecologists trying to figure out, in a world where there are ever more human impacts that are fragmenting the landscape into smaller pieces, how do we preserve wildlife's room to roam, their ability to freely migrate across political boundaries, across ownership fence lines, particularly in an era being changed where we're dealing with a changing climate. So not just for wildlife migration, but their seasonal daily needs. We started realizing that the public estate, the Forest Service lands, the BLM lands, are not enough really to provide this ability for wildlife to continue to roam and meet their needs. But in fact, private lands, in particular large working ranches, are really important components of the landscape. And of course, you know, we knew that the private lands support most species at some portion of their annual needs. But nobody that we know of had really looked across the West and thought about how many large working ranches are there out there that are in critical areas for wildlife? Who owns these places? How are they run? And would they be interested in a conversation with conservationists about these issues?
And were they interested in that conversation? In other words, what was in it for them?
Well, originally we called around all of the Western states. We found a number of ranchers who had for a long time been trying to marry conservation and sustainable profitability on their ranches. And we convened them together in a series of meetings over about a year and a half to ask the question, are there more people out there like you who are trying to make for that marriage? How does one accomplish this marriage of conservation and profitability? And is there a value in connecting us together, both conservationists with these landowners, but also finding more landowners and bringing them together to have this conversation? And one of the things the landowners replied was, well, what would be in it for the landowner? The short answer we've come to find is that these landowners that we're bringing together over that year and a half or so have said, you know, there's no organization that represents our full suite of interests. There's the Farm Bureau, there's the Cattlemen's Associations, there's some conservation groups that we can work with, but there isn't really an organization focused on sharing lessons, sharing best practices and knowledge across all these landscapes from landowner to landowner, and then representing us in policy questions at the state and federal level. And so that we would really benefit from having that sort of peer forum. And that really birthed the Western Landowners Alliance. So we've intentionally, in creating this alliance, made sure that the bylaws state it is a landowner-led organization to represent landowners, but we intentionally have built into its structure a diversity that includes scientists, agency folks, conservation organization representatives, so that we can have very honest conversations about the diversity of perspectives on all of these relevant topics.
I mean, one thing that I think people, especially urban people, have a lot of trouble sorting out is what are the various things going on? For example, on your ranch, you're owner of the Mountain Island Ranch, Mary, what are the various things you do, including but beyond raising cattle?
Well, on our ranch, we're entirely organic at this point, which was something that took many years to accomplish. We manage a wildlife population up in our high country. We work with Fish and Game in their Ranching for Wildlife program. And so there's a lot of different aspects to managing and maintaining a landscape, especially across two states, which goes beyond just cattle ranching. I mean, you're managing specific resources and populations of wildlife. We have a program in which we're trying to cooperate in protecting the sage grouse and the leks that are on our property, and it's quite comprehensive.
How is it good for ranchers? I mean, this is the question, and this is what's sort of been so surprising to me, is what's in it for ranchers to conserve species? I mean, we have this sort of set of ideas about industrial ranching, feedlot cattle, and all that. But you've got an organic grass-fed ranch. You're producing healthy beef. What is in it for you and others like you to conserve sage grouse, for example?
Well, I think to begin with, most landowners love their land. And the environment in which they live is comprised of a lot of different things, including the wildlife. It's one of the things that makes me feel good and happiest is to not only conserve the land, but conserve the species that live on the land, to conserve the habitats where those species are found. Our ranch has a fairly robust hunting program, which is important to us. It's important to the bottom line. And when you're working with a constantly shifting bottom line, and you know, the cattle industry is not something you can rely on always being robust and healthy. You know, you look at all aspects of the landscape that you live in and manage.
Talk about that, Kenyon, in the context of wildlife migration. First of all, this whole concept of what a wildlife corridor is, can you kind of explain that a little bit?
Sure. I think the simplest way to explain that is think about how dependent human societies are on highways and railways to distribute our food, to move us around, to connect us. If you were to suddenly take away the highways, or if you imagine, let's say, a string of islands with bridges between them, and you remove the bridges and populations are stranded, that's in effect what's been happening to wildlife habitat over the past couple hundred years. And so wildlife corridors, you know, can be defined a number of different ways, but in short, they're the bridges between the islands, between the core habitats. A lot of times, private working ranches are the core habitats. Sometimes they are more of the corridors. And speaking to what Mary just said, pretty much every rancher I've ever met takes their job as land steward incredibly seriously and with a pride. It's often a multi-generational situation where the generation managing right now wants to do right by their grandparents and keep the legacy going, and they want to look upon a productive, healthy landscape, knowing that there are, let's say, pronghorn antelope who migrate through their landscape every year, usually makes them happy and proud. But there's the problem of fence lines and different jurisdictions that don't coincide neatly with nature's borders, because nature doesn't have borders, right? So what happens to a pronghorn that has safe refuge on a working ranch, jumps over the fence, and is suddenly in, you know, the middle of an oil and gas field or an interstate? It can't get to the next working ranch or wilderness area. So what we've been doing is trying to find ways to help these species move from ranch to ranch and find out who is the rancher next door and what do they think about having pronghorn. And maybe there are some habitat improvements they could do, or fence improvements, like remove the top wire, because pronghorns are lousy jumpers, very fast, but lousy jumpers. And they would do it if they only had, you know, the financial incentive to make it worth them taking their precious time. You know, most ranchers don't have a lot of extra time or resources. So if we can help them remove that fifth wire, fourth wire, they're often very willing to help out.
One of the things I think is really important, and it's an ongoing conversation and it's a policy conversation, is sometimes there are incentives to do conservation and sort of have the best of both worlds. You've got a working ranch, you've got pronghorn antelope being able to migrate. In some cases, there's real disincentives, like landowners get actually kind of punished for doing conservation, for doing the right thing?
It's an issue that we are very much concerned with. It ranges across a number of different policy realms. But for example, currently, many of our ranchers are in a situation because of state policy such that if they were to not irrigate some of their hay fields and instead return that water to the river or the creek that runs through their property for, let's say, maybe the sake of the trout population, they're going to lose their water right. That is a, you know, what we feel is a ridiculous disincentive to doing the right thing on the land. Or, for example, maybe Mary, you could speak to resting the river farm and then having to revive it just to maintain your water right.
Yeah, for a number of years, we have a farm that's on the Colorado River. It's actually the first water right in Utah. And it's very remote. It's an inholding in a wilderness area. And it's extremely complex and expensive to manage and to try to farm it. Yet we have, that's our largest water right. It's 10 CFS on the out of the river. And if I were not to be practicing agriculture down there, I would essentially lose the water right. So for years I looked into partnerships and possible leasing of the water, you know, any option that I might have had to not start up the farm and use the water for conservation purposes, keeping water in the river. I was interested in trying to keep it in the river all the way to California. I was interested in wetlands, and, you know, it was a real research project, and we didn't get very far on it.
Well, at the end of the day,
talked to many people. And
well, Mary, you know, let those fields rest for almost 7 years and then had to restart that farm just to maintain the water right in the seventh year.
At great expense, and it affects the bottom line in a big way.
Right.
But we're not prepared to let that water right go at the moment.
It affects the bottom line in a big way in the sense that you lose money on that
big
farm.
Big time.
We are talking to Kenyon Fields and Mary Conover about the work of the Western Landowners Alliance. Now, there's a movement afoot, of course, to change these things, but it's very hard because, I mean, we live in bureaucracies.
Well, legislators and agency decision makers and, you know, the powers that be, so to speak, typically respond to public input of a certain sort. And there's a saying, politics follows culture. What we're doing at Western Landowners Alliance is assembling and organizing that culture into an organization that can then be, you know, a megaphone of ranchers' concerns, conservation-minded ranchers, to speak with, you know, the higher levels of agencies and Congress and so forth, to express our concerns, but not to complain, to say, look, this is what it's really like on the ground. This is how these policies translate on the ground for us, and we have some constructive solutions for how we can change the system so that it actually works for people and works for wildlife and conservation. And what we're finding is that we're getting listened to because we're Democrats and we're Republicans, and we're managers and landowners from, you know, I think we're up to maybe 14 million acres from around the West. That's a constituency that these decision makers want to hear from.
Now, both Democrats and Republicans are listening?
We find that we sometimes get a blank stare after we're done with our introduction because people can't figure out who we are. We don't fit into that lefty box or that righty box. We're not speaking from the usual rhetoric, and we're not here to complain, you know, and then badmouth their decisions and their processes. We find we get an audience on both sides of the spectrum.
Very interesting. So you're basically going to legislators, whether it be federal or state, saying, we represent landowners, ranchers. I think it's predominantly ranchers, but also farmers.
Primarily ranchers, where the ranching entails a farming component.
Okay.
Yeah.
And saying, here's what's going on the ground. Here's why it's messed up. Here's some constructive solutions. We can help you. You can help us.
Exactly.
It's a new organization, so a lot of this is still really in process.
Yes, it's very much still in progress. We're building those relationships, introducing ourselves. But I think when you speak with the staff, you'll realize that we've already had enormous success in a number of issues. For example, in oil and gas and shallow fracking. Long story short, the system is not set up to do a good job of gaining the landowner input for leasing. And I think Leslie Allison, our executive director, has done a fantastic job of alerting certain powers that be that the process is imperfect and here's a constructive way to fix it. And they said, you're right. I'm sure you can get many examples from them like that.
Right. You come from a conservation biology background. What is the relationship like between ranchers and conservationists? I mean, traditionally, it's been quite contentious and nobody's listening to each other. Here are the two of you married together having these conversations. Here's the Western Landowners Alliance having these conversations. What does it look like?
I'd say, to just put it bluntly, ranchers and conservationists typically have not had the best rapport. There are organizations that use language like welfare ranching to describe ranchers' use of leased public lands at low cost for those grazing allotments. There are a lot of lawsuits filed by certain organizations over the grazing issue, but largely claiming overgrazing as the problem. And so, as an organization, we've said, we're not interested in that. We're not interested in that fight. We're all talking about the same landscapes, the same species. What would happen if we were to talk to each other in these circumstances, come up with as close to a joint solution as we can, that we can both live with a bit? And again, speaking to the diversity of the organization's composition of members and staff and leaders, we intentionally have people who come from both worlds or who straddle both worlds so that we can talk. Some of us have respect in the conservation group circles. Some of us have respect in the ranching world. And that allows us to bring interests together that might not otherwise talk, which is one of the most exciting things to me about this organization.
Give us some examples of where ranching interests and conservation interests really differ from each other and examples of where they intersect. Because I think having interviewed a bunch of people from the Kivira Coalition conference recently and looking at people who are essentially looking at their land less and less as commodity production and more as an ecosystem. And it turns out when you look at it as an ecosystem, sometimes you actually get more productivity than if you're trying to kind of whip the land to your will.
Well, I'd say the video we just watched this morning that staff made of our board member Jeff Laszlo's restoration project on his ranch in Montana speaks of that perfectly. The land was literally whipped into shape by his grandfather in an old 1950s era way of thinking about whipping the land into shape, which meant canalize this wetlands, turn it into linear ditches.
I mean, that's, to our sensibilities now, you think you've got these wetlands that are like places where migratory birds stop and that are feeding the land and cleaning the water, and they try to dry them out by making straight canals through them.
Well, it wasn't that long ago that settlers moving west saw these giant old-growth redwood trees as an impossible hurdle on the way to development and getting to the coast, and they just wanted them out of the way. Look how we treat them today. So times change, and clearly in the Madison Valley where Jeff's grandfather, settled this ranch, they needed to divert this water and take care of this swamp and turn it into productive lands. Well, over the years, they weren't so productive anymore, and the wildlife weren't there so much anymore. And so Jeff, in a brilliant move of establishing various public-private partnerships, was able to raise the funding support and the technical expertise, and they spent a decade re-engineering this back into a wetland. And within a couple months of the project's completion, had not just trout back in the streams spawning and sandhill cranes and tundra swans landing there in their stopovers, but Jeff said the overall productivity of his working cattle ranch, his hay and cattle operation, increased because of the health of the soils and the more natural water flows and this, that, and the other. And so, you know, in his case, that was an enormous effort. But then within a couple of months, they noticed the difference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's an argument to be made because of the overgrazing in the West, which is a real phenomenon that's happened over well over a century. I mean, there is an argument to be made, and conservationists make this argument that cattle should be taken off of land in the West, particularly public lands, and many of the people who have ranches, they have private land, but it's adjacent to public land, and there's a much larger swath of public land that they use to graze their cattle. Let's take your ranch as an example. Suppose you were to say from one day to the next, okay, no more cattle. What would happen?
Well, we've actually talked about that. And it's an interesting question. I think that you can take a certain number of years of rest on your public allotments. But again, it's not unlike the water rights. If you don't use them, they would be leased to someone else eventually. And that's one thing we don't want to see happen in our landscape, because we feel very strongly that we manage it in a way that we try never to overgraze it.
We run quite a few fewer head than permitted to.
We're about 60% at our capacity. The ranch is entirely under conservation easement. You know, we're trying to balance these conservation values, maintaining the landscape using cattle as a tool, but also not allowing ourselves to overgraze or put the land at jeopardy for the long term.
And I'm no range expert, but I'm not ashamed to say I think there are places where cattle don't belong. There weren't bison to begin with in any significant numbers. And to say, well, we need these animals here to, you know, take care of the landscape. Well, it's only because we created a problem in the first place. You know, the elk and the deer in the case of this ranch were the primary inhabitants. And there's some evidence that there were few bison there, but not significant numbers. So to tell me the landscape needs cattle, I'm not there. Maybe the cattle can be used surgically to do some restoration. And we've seen many of our members do that very well. But, you know, to some of those organizations who think cattle don't belong on the public range or even on some private parcels, I see some of their arguments why. But we live in the real world. And in the real world, if we, like Mary said, just stop running cattle and stop irrigating to grow hay, you lose your public allotments, you lose your water right, you lose your agricultural tax status, and guess what happens? You end up having to sell the ranch and split it up into subdivisions, which bring roads and, you know, all this, that, and the other, because you can't pay for it anymore. And then you leave to chance who's going to end up with those permits and what they're going to do with it. And we know what our conservation values and vision are, and that if we're in charge of those allotments, they're going to be treated as best we can. But we don't know how someone else might if they get those.
You have assembled this group of people together, and it's a growing organization, the Western Landowners Alliance. When you look at the people who are not in this organization, who are landowners, whose values maybe are not so much in line with conservation practices and philosophies, what percentage of Western landowners are thinking the way you guys think? Are you guys a tiny fringe minority? Or
I would argue that we're not. I mean, I've seen in the last 40 years that I've been out here, the demographics of the West are changing rapidly and dramatically. And I think a lot of the landowners that are out there have very similar values. They may not be able to necessarily have access to the information or afford to do certain things like put conservation easements on their property. When we first came to Glade Park, my mother started putting conservation easements on the ranch, and a lot of our neighbors were very skeptical. I mean, it looked like a, you know, lands taking sort of situation to them. And now there are two or three of the biggest ranches up there are also putting conservation easements on their properties. And, you know, I think it takes time. And I think that, you know, the information is out there. And I think there's many more landowners of like mind as we have in this organization. And I think that's part of our mission, is to reach those landowners.
Mary Conover is owner of Mountain Island Ranch. Kenyon Fields is a founding member of the Western Landowners Alliance, background in conservation biology. I want to thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It's been our pleasure. Thanks.
The Western Landowners Alliance is on the web at westernlandownersalliance.org.